Hello and welcome to Irreverent Testimony, brought to you by Netroots Radio, the political podcast by and for millennial and Gen Xer types from a left-winged perspective. It is Saturday, April 1st, 2017, and we are beyond delighted and excited to have a very special guest with us, writer, comedian, producer, part-time TV personality.
Gonzo journalist, I think.
Gonzo journalist, that's a good one. Mr. Harmon Leon. Harmon, thank you so much for joining us. We are super excited to have you on here and talk about some stuff.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. That's a really long title. Like, if I had that printed on a business card, that would be a really long business card, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Just like tiny font that you just couldn't read, but we had to get it all in there. So I'm Travis.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm actually a big fan. We're both big fans. I'm a big fan going back, like, to the Bush administration. I kind of had seen your stuff here and there. I bought Republican Like Me, like, when it came out. Like, I don't know if it was the day it came out, but I had kind of heard about it. I went right to Barnes & Noble and bought it, and I have reread it maybe a dozen times. And I want to talk about that a little bit because so much of it rings kind of frightening in a way where you did this kind of undercover stuff, infiltrating these ridiculous, awful racists and scary white people. And sort of the underlying theme, and sometimes you even say it in the book kind of out loud, is, holy shit, what if these people, like, were in charge? And now they're basically in charge.
Yes.
So, yeah, there's that reflection. I just think it's always kind of evil resurfaces itself every few years. And then for satirists, it always gives us, you know, something to sink our claws into, you know, when there's a villain in the White House.
Yeah, you know, there's always something for satirists to dig their claws into, even if, like, all the branches of government are more or less represented by factions you kind of agree with. There's always plenty to work with, but now it's just like comical heights, and every day is just like gobsmacking, jaw dropping. Like, is this really happening?
Yeah, we're just in really uncharted territory. Yep. where no rules apply.
So I sort of came to that book later, just a couple of days ago, in fact. And I was reading about your coverage of Arnold Schwarzenegger's bid for governor and how sort of went undercover. Yeah. And you're describing this, like, sort of circus and this sideshow and this kind of, like, isn't this crazy? This guy's just like an action star with nothing to say and no policy, anything. And reading it in today's time was sort of... I don't know. It seemed a little quaint because Arnold turned out to not be.
I would crave an Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, he's a fucking Kennedy compared to what we have now.
Well, he's
exactly. Yeah, because you know, a few months back when he was having that, like, there, you know, and we're actually saying, you know, our president gets in Twitter battles with people, you know, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he took the upper hand and was witty. And, you know, just like we were on Arnold Schwarzenegger's side, that does seem quaint, doesn't it?
It does. And, like, your description of working on Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign for whatever the couple days that you did, and your description of, like, the circus and, like, how ridiculous it is, and this man, and the whole, I mean, that entire campaign for governor back then, the recall and the, like, Gary Coleman and Larry Flint and, like, I mean, all the ridiculous people that were running is ridiculous. It was then and it still is. But I was just reading it and thinking about, like, could you possibly have foreseen Donald Trump, the reality television star, billionaire narcissist, ascending to the White House? And how do you feel about, like, that campaign versus what we're going through now? And, like, I don't know, thoughts, reflections?
No, like I said, that just seemed like a, you know, we would gladly have a Schwarzenegger now if that was the choice of the evils. And actually, he didn't even turn out that horrible.
We were talking about that yesterday. Yeah. That he, I mean, he governed the way you would think a California governor should govern, but he, you know, he was pretty good on environmental stuff. He was okay on LGBT stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was terrible for the economy, and Brown has had to fix a lot of that. But you know, the total report card, it's like, yeah, Schwarzenegger
he wasn't that bad. I mean, he was a Republican, but he governed by his constituents, and his constituents are largely liberal, and so he kind of came around to the table and did not such a bad job, as opposed to Donald Trump, who everyone, I think, was hoping would be a Schwarzenegger, and is just turning into a fucking shit show.
Yeah, that was kind of the hope. Like, well, maybe he's not an ideologue, and maybe he'll just kind of...
Maybe he'll be fine.
Like, no, he has
He'll surround himself with smart people.
He has
no idea what he's doing.
And he's just... He's literally doing everything to spite Obama. Like, that's his platform.
Yeah, there's no plan in that. He's just throwing things out there just because of that one White House correspondence dinner where Obama was just like ripping into him. It just seems like this like crazy vendetta
that doesn't make any sense. It's like the it's like the Superman origin story. Like a science experiment made Lex Luthor lose his hair, so now he wants to blow up the world. I mean, like what the F is going on? And it literally is like he wants to wipe away environmental regulations, you know, with some cover bullshit about stifling innovation, but it's really because this is what Obama wanted, and we have to repeal Obamacare because it has the name Obama in it, and all the shit that Obama liked, I'm against. That is literally his platform.
Well, you know, just, I mean, you could break it down week by week, you know. So this week, he wanted to bring back all the coal mining jobs, and like what's he going to do next? Like bring back all the work for chimney sweeps and laugh makers next? It's just like,
you know,
kind of like
there aren't any asbestos factories around anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah.
Yes.
He's going to bring back all the work for cobblers.
Right.
You know how many people were working at the DDT factory in 1953, for God's sake?
Make
America great again.
Well, it's just like it's just a scenario where no one's going to be happy because he's not going to bring back jobs of an antiquated energy form where it's just like should be focused on new technology. And so those people aren't going to be happy.
Of course not.
And everyone else, when he destroys the environment, they're not going to be happy. So that's where we're at.
The thing is, the ironic, terribly depressing thing about that is like Hillary actually had the sensible approach. She's basically like, look, guys, coal mining jobs suck. Like, you get black lung and die at 40 and your benefits suck because these companies are horrible to you. How about, like, we bring in, like, green energy jobs and do all the shit, but they captured a soundbite where she said, I'm going to put coal miners out of business, and that's all anybody cared about, that's all anybody heard. And Trump jumped in and said, I'm going to reopen mines.
What about those emails, though?
The emails, for one thing.
Yeah, so just sad and... sad on Hillary's part, you know, just that it's kind of like in foresight when you know, like, your neighbor's like a serial killer, and then you go, oh, yeah, he was a serial killer. And then you look back at like sound bites like that and go, oh, okay, yeah, that's how she did not get those votes.
Yep. Yeah, but you know what? West Virginia wasn't the problem. There was never an electoral map where it was like, you know what, we really have to carry, you know, West Virginia and Appalachia, you know, to. It goes way beyond that, and we can get into that stuff if we want to.
Sure.
But I do want to pivot a little bit and talk about a funny story. Actually, the other day, how we decided to invite you on the program, Rachel was in the bathtub.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was in a lot of pain, and I...
Oh, no.
Yeah, well...
long story, she's okay now.
I'm fine. But I said to Travis, I'm going to take a bath, and I want you to read me a story. And... I don't care what it is, but come read me a story. And he picked your book. He picked Republican Like Me. And he sat and he read me the I met some white supremacists at an Applebee's. And
which is still it was might be my favorite from the book.
Oh, but. My God. Yeah, it was amazing. That's how I was introduced to you, actually, mm-hmm. was from that little event. And God.
Well, I guess my point is with that, like, I read it now, and I guess the first 10 or 15 minutes we're giggling and we're laughing, and then it, like, kind of starts to get very depressing because we're kind of realizing, like, these people are out of the shadows. They're emboldened to take to the streets, and granted, people like Richard Spencer get punched, and it's great, but not that he's great, but it's great that he gets punched, and everybody can rally around that, but... it's like now we've given these people a platform, and I think it's kind of being met by a lot of the Beltway media and media at large kind of with a shrug, like, huh, that's weird. I don't know what we're supposed to do with that.
What are we supposed to do with these people?
Yeah.
Like, are we supposed to present the other side, or are we supposed to just... It's
pretend
okay,
it's not there.
Or just they're not really saying what they're saying, or how do we do this? Like, we've progressed to a time where racism is no longer a thing that's acceptable, but now it's in the White House, and so the media is sort of just like, what?
Well, like,
Well, I think it's just like what they did was just a whole rebranding approach, you know? You just call it alt-right, and it's just rebrand it, and then you throw out things like, we don't have time to be politically correct, which means we have plenty of time to be racist. And with the Applebee's story, it's, you know, that's just like, pretty much, you know, they look like anyone else there at Applebee's, which is like
pasty,
you know,
white,
kinda,
boring. Yeah.
Yeah. Eating nachos. It's just like with your white supremacists, you want them to be wearing like hoods and doing Hitler salutes.
Right. And meet like at somebody's barn, you know.
You don't want them to be eating fajitas and drinking, you know, margaritas at Applebee's and looking like everyone else at Applebee's. And if you didn't know they're white supremacists, you would just think they're anyone else there at Applebee's. You know, you kind of want to brand your white supremacists with an evil face. And when they look like everyone else, you know, obviously that's, to me, is more disturbing. You know?
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's like they walk among us, is
making,
what I'm saying.
Right, and making goo-goo eyes at the baby and like...
The guy's a software engineer and the chick, well, the chick was a little nuts. The one who was at, I think, UC Santa Cruz and got kicked out for putting up swastikas everywhere. But
yeah, as he would.
As one would hope would be ostracized.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but now she's got an argument to make about safe spaces or... Liberals want safe spaces, so we're violating her First Amendment rights. Like, I was kind of looking to see if you had commented on the whole Milo stuff a month ago, because we talked a lot about that.
Yeah. What was your – I mean, I have two takes on it. Obviously, you know, against everything he has to say. But secondly, when you try to shut him down, like at Berkeley, you know, it's just like one thing is you having the right to protest you know, to shut down free speech is like you have that right because there is free speech. So, you know,
it's
double-edged sword, you know.
Well, I think especially when you come from a comedy space, there's this always been this argument within comedy about free speech and what that means. And I'm sort of coming from a place of like unabashed feminism where I say like, you absolutely have the right to say whatever you want, and I have the right to call you an asshole.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it just so happens that you show up in a space where you're saying something and there happen to be 10,000 people who are calling you a racist fuckface all at the same time,
right?
Well, that's the cost of doing business.
I mean, that's just – I mean, you don't – the thing that kills me is like the Sarah Palin argument about like – oh, my free speech is being infringed upon because someone said I was an asshole. And it's like, no, you still have the right to say whatever the fuck you want to say. No one's putting you in jail for saying that, right? It's the same thing with Milo. No one's putting you in jail. No one is taking away your freedom for saying that. On the other hand, free speech does not grant you immunity from criticism.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, I think what put him in perspective is seeing him on Bill Maher's show where, you know, he was I forgot who the guests were, but, you know, they were pretty sharp tools. And, you know, he just kind of all he did was just, you know, he's just basically a troll, you know, an internet troll.
Yeah.
When it came to actually, you know, being face to face with people and debating, he just took, you know, internet troll tactics and really didn't, you know, he just said, can't you get smarter guests on?
You're all
no, that's not an argument.
Like,
that's just you're just being a snarky troll. That's not contributing to your argument. That's just, And you know, it just showed it's like, yeah, you're not that clever.
I think
the you're just like, you know, the troll tactics. That's
of course, exactly. And I think the difference is Milo knows exactly what he's doing. He knows what's going to fire
yeah.
up. Fire
he knows how
us
to push
up.
The buttons.
He knows to fire up how yeah. to fire up his base. Sarah Palin, I think, is actually too stupid to understand that free speech is a two-way street.
yes.
It's hard, or maybe
yeah, she's even relevant anymore. No, when you see her like occasionally pop up, you know, like on Daily Beast or something, it's just like, no, you're not. You have no relevance anymore.
Well,
like,
I thought she was going to get a cabinet position.
The crazy aunt. Oh God, yeah. There we go.
Maybe when McMaster has had enough and he quits, Trump will just name her national security.
But you're right. Like she's the crazy aunt that you're like, wait, you're talking.
Yeah.
What? Why are you talking? Who's listening to you?
Who
no
gave
one.
Aunt Sarah
yeah.
Who gave Aunt Sarah a microphone? Why are you? Why are you talking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who refilled her gin and tonic?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So. Yeah. Exactly.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead, Harmon.
No, that was it. I just said we have some fun with Sarah Palin when she comes out every now and then.
Oh, it's not like there's it's like, oh, we miss Sarah Palin.
She puts a smile on her face because she doesn't, you know, she wields no power and will never, you know, be back to her prominence of whatever she had. So, you know, let her say her dumb things. It puts a smile on her face.
Well, you know, the free speech thing is an interesting argument because I'll give you a counterexample. In the early days of the Iraq War, the George W. Mm-hmm. Bush Iraq War, right away off the bat, you had some people going to sort of college commencements and things and speaking out against it. And for the most part, they got booed and yelled down because when a war first happens, everybody rallies around the flag for the most part, especially people who don't know any mm-hmm. better. And who have never been through a war and don't know what it looks like a lot of college students. And a lot of liberals were making the Milo argument. This is, you know, they're shutting down free speech. This is Nazi-esque. And I'm kind of like, well, she said her piece. And those in the audience reacted with their free speech. And that's kind of how it goes. Of course, they came around very quickly when they realized, you know, all the truths we now know about the Iraq War. But...
and like war is bad and stuff.
War, yeah.
Right. Sure.
Oh, wait a minute. War is, people get blowed up. My cousin got blowed up by an IED. That's not good, actually. Oh, we forget about that every 20 years or so. But, you know, I like kind of watching what you do, sort of the gonzo journalist stuff and the infiltration kind of stuff. And you've been doing this for a long time in a lot of different aspects. Like we were watching a little bit of your last night, your Minuteman. Infiltration.
Yeah.
Which was kind of fun. And it's like, I was kind of thinking when I'm watching that though, like, are they bummed now? Now that like, cause they always had an excuse, right? Under Clinton and even under W where they didn't really like his immigration policies. And of course under Obama,
right.
They're like, well, we have to do this because the government isn't doing their job. It's like now that Trump is actually sort of beefing up, letting ICE run amok like stormtroopers. And he's talking about building a wall. Like, are they like, well, shit, what do we do now?
Yeah, well, actually, that group imploded, so that group's no longer around. But,
as most of them do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, their big thing is, like, the government, you know, the government's not doing their job. Let's impeach the president.
Right.
You know, but now it's like, yeah, I mean, that's the weird thing. You know, it's just like all these fringe groups have become mainstream in their ideology.
Yes.
So, yeah, yes. I mean.
It's weird because, you know. In Colorado, which is where we're from, we have a lot of these people. Like, we're like, you know, the Mountain Men and Fiercely Independent and whatever. And so we sort of have this weird microcosm of tons of militiamen. Even though we're not a border state, we just sort of attract, and it's not just Minutemen, it's like these sort of militia style type people who want to protect against government overreach or whatever, right?
Right.
And what I think is interesting is like I've been making fun of these people my whole life, right? Like I just find them to be ludicrous. And now that Donald Trump is the president, I'm like, oh, so hi guys. I know I've been making fun of you my whole life, but now might be your moment where you actually have to protect the citizens of this country from the government.
Yeah.
And okay.
Is there going to be a weird...
In a way, you see their point of view now.
Yes, I do. Like, the fate of the Republic might be in danger, and you might actually be necessary for me to help me.
Yeah,
so
but most
maybe...
of the
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I did a story recently, or not recently, within the last year on this group called the Oath Keepers, and that was their whole deal of... you know, they were just, you know, everything was about, like, if they take away our guns, you know, the government's going to put us in 24/7 FEMA camps. And So I guess, in a way, now I'm sort of seeing, like, what you just said, their point of view.
Yeah, because I feel like, you know, if we're just going to allow the federal government to come and swoop people up and put them in camps, which is what's happening with ICE in our state, I kind of want to go to them and be like, hey, so... I know we don't agree on anything except this one thing about this government thing being like overreaching and putting people in camps. That's happening. So this is your moment and you can be a patriot now and you can prevent people being put in camps. You have guns. I don't. So come help me. I don't know. I mean, it sounds crazy, but I'm living in a crazy fucking world. I don't know what to do. And these people seem like they've been preparing for some moment and they just need someone to say, here's your moment. And I'm like, hi, here's your moment. I know it's not what you thought, but help immigrants and stop political dissidents from being jailed. And like, let's work together.
You know what might be a good angle?
Yeah.
They want to sell your web browsing history.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah.
You want your wife looking that up online like Ashley Madison? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Keep the government out of my porn browsing.
Yeah. But it's like with those Oath Keeper guys, I mean, they're basically, I mean, they're pretty much anti-immigration.
Sure.
Like,
I know.
Because they're just like, it is crazy, just like, you know, when you infiltrate these groups, just to get, what I always find fascinating is just to get into their thought process of how they regurgitate information through their filter. And with their filter was like, okay, you know, if you let immigrants in, they're going to vote liberal. And if you vote liberal, the liberals want to take away our guns. So we can't let immigrants in.
Mm.
The take away the gun thing just never seems to die, no matter how ridiculous it proves on the face. And I think it's sort of a self-fulfilling idea. Like, they're still waiting for Obama to swoop in and take their guns, even though he's not even president anymore. And
yeah, but he's working in that secret government.
Right. That the shadow government. Yeah. Wiretapping everybody.
Obama's just like kite surfing and just enjoying his time off.
He
and
looks
just
so
like
happy.
Not even beaming in, like, with this ludicrous state of the world we're living in until possibly necessary.
Well, that time could be coming soon, but. The point kind of is like, okay, after Clinton and whoever and Obama did not take away their guns, they never stop and go, you know, maybe that whole they're going to take our guns thing and we ran out and stockpiled all this ammo, maybe that was stupid. No. I think they're like, well, we made so much noise and such a racket, we scared
them away
from taking our guns.
Yeah.
So it'll just never stop. It's like the dog that barks at the door and he thinks that he scared the danger away every single time.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and the ludicrous thing about it is, like, every time there is, like, you know, an issue with, okay, so we're going to have, you know, we're going to make it, you know, harder for crazy people to get guns. Gun sales soar. They skyrocket because people stockpile going, uh-oh, we better get all the weapons we can. You know, that's always, like, a trajectory sad trajectory of what happens. Like, just people stockpile weapons and gun sales go up every time there is a scare that legislation is going to come in and, you know, just sort of not ban guns, just sort of curve it away from mentally unstable people.
Right. Well, and I heard that the Trump presidency has actually really been bad for gun sales. There was a story I read on, I don't remember, but like NBC or something that was like some gun seller in Mississippi was like, yeah, sales are really down. We're really in trouble. And I'm like, oh my God.
Poor baby.
Like, yeah. And just to jump off of that point, one of my most recent stories I did was I did a story on all these gun stores across America that are banning Muslims from their stores.
Oh my God.
And that's just a whole nother like crazy wow. trajectory.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just that just, level just, of crazy is just, that's just piling on and piling on. Okay.
And yeah. And don't expect the Sessions Justice Department to prosecute those cases.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just basically stores that have like sort of Jim Crow era signs in their windows just saying, this is a Muslim free zone,
wow.
you know, in
wow.
2017, that's wow. what we're seeing. So again, it's just like, that's just a whole nother level of craziness of the gun culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's, I didn't know that. That's just, but like, of course,
yeah, conversation
like, of course,
suffer.
Like, of course, like they, it's yeah. not surprising. And of course it goes there. And like, so, oh yeah. Okay.
Well, I just think that's yeah. just a, you know, microcosm of, you know, just the whole Trump anti-immigration mentality, yeah. Yeah. you know, and I try to like, yeah. you know, focus it through, these stores that are just, you know,
gun you know, stores just, that ban Muslims. Like that's like a perfect, yeah. like, nugget of just everything that is happening. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's yeah. what I was, you know, trying to say. It's not, you know, about the gun culture. It's just right. like about, a good portion of our culture,
yeah,
told through these gun stores. So, yeah. again, sorry, I just brought a whole downer down on this whole
it's
conversation.
No, it's just one of those like, if you were to ask me if that would ever to be, like, yeah, of course, yeah. There's a gun store that's a Muslim free zone because that's where we are. That makes yeah. perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're all you know. Terrorists, according to the gun store guys. So, you know, again, it's just getting inside these guys' heads of like how they process the information.
Yeah. All right. Well, while we're on a down note, I really want to talk to you about the article that you wrote about the failure of the American people and the media and everyone else around the AIDS epidemic in the 80s.
Yeah.
You wrote this article for Vice.
Sorry, I just sounded really enthusiastic about that. Yeah.
No, I thought yeah, it yeah. was a really, I really loved the article, and I really appreciated it. And I think particularly because we sort of talk to millennials and that's kind of our base. I think mm-hmm. people don't understand
yeah.
what happened in the 80s.
They didn't live through it.
They didn't live through it. They didn't lose.
And they don't have
90% of their friends.
Older gay friends or relatives.
Yeah, because
who
they all
it.
Fucking died.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So I think it's, I really think it's important to educate people about what happened. And it's not just that everyone died. Because that's true. We lost an entire generation, essentially, mm-hmm. of men. But the failures were around the media and the government. And you have this really interesting, I think, note about comedy and its role. And sort of not its role, but sort of its reflection of where culture was and society was
sure.
at the time. And so... Yeah, I just really loved the article, and I just wanted to talk about it for a minute. So I really thought it was interesting that the guy – so everybody probably heard a couple years ago there was like a, mm-hmm. a report or like a leaked video, right, of like people laughing about
yeah, yeah.
AIDS
actually,
crisis.
Yeah, me and my filmmaking partner, we did that video. We uncovered this he works for he used to work for like congressional library, so he has like all these access to archive audio. So cool. It was basically they would laugh at Ronald Reagan's like press secretary every time it was brought up. All the whole press pool would just laugh at the notion of AIDS. And this one guy, and he's actually, you know, he's sort of like this fringe sort of reporter.
Yeah, like, I have his
Larry
name as
Cassini's.
Lester
probably,
Kinsolver.
Yeah, Lester. Yeah. And so they would just laugh at him because he was sort of like a fool. They're sort of like an all-knowing fool when you bring up the AIDS crisis at, you know, like say your daily Sean Spicer-esque, you know, daily briefing. So, and this happened for years. You know, it wasn't like until 1985, like Ronald Reagan even acknowledged that there was like an AIDS crisis.
Well, the first time he ever said it was 85.
Yeah.
Right. So this guy, this Lester Kinsolving guy, who was asking about AIDS in the press pool and being laughed at and like mocked, and he's a weirdo, fringy guy, and like he,
the interesting thing is that he's
absolutely an opponent of gay rights, hates gays.
Yeah, that is the weird part about that as well. So yeah, so sorry, go ahead. I don't want to.
No, I just think that's so interesting. I had no idea. I figured this was some guy from, I don't know, part of the movement who was like trying to ask questions to the press secretary and being mocked. Turns out he was like, he's a fringy weirdo, but he also like hates gay people, right? And he's the person who sort of kept bringing this issue forward.
Yeah, so you don't really know what, you know, his true sort of motive was to bring it up, but he did bring it up. And he kept bringing it up, and you know, in just hearing the audio of them, you know, just making like homophobic jokes every time he would bring it up, it's just like, you know, it's like you're saying like, you know, the right always says like Ronald Reagan's the greatest American president, and this was like, you know, this was on his watch, you know.
That's right.
I think there's
and for years, not even like once, it was like for years he went.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. He wouldn't address it.
It was I'm sorry, Rachel.
No, he just, I mean, tens and hundreds of thousands of people died from a disease that he would not address because it was seen as a gay disease.
Right, and like, I'm going to get to all the failures in that. You had the failure of the media who really didn't dig into the science and just reported it as a gay disease because that was the equivalent of clickbait in the 80s, watch bait, whatever you want to call it. You had some folks in the comedy world who used it as a very, very cheap pickup line. Oh, make fun of gay people. People laugh at that, you know. So there was that failure. There was certainly the failure of the government, as we know, to take it seriously in any capacity.
Put funding into it, have the, you know, NIH or anybody do anything. I mean, it was massively awful. This is just talking about the media. I'm going to quote you really quick, Carmen. This is a quote from the article that I read that I thought was astounding. In 1981, the New York Times published only 3 stories on AIDS, and just 3 stories in 1982, none of which made the front page. The Times didn't put AIDS on the front page until the following year. By contrast, the cyanide-laced Tylenol pills that killed 7 people in 1982 resulted in a massive media panic, with the New York Times covering the story every single day that October. So tens of thousands of people were dying of AIDS, and it made 3 stories in the New York Times.
People lost their 7 fucking minds people. Over the Chicago Tylenol thing. I'm old enough to remember that as a kid.
Yeah. Well,
I wasn't born yet, but.
I mean, it's just a reflection on the country at the time, because, you know, you have the Christian right, you know, coming in, and it's like, well, that's just a choice. They're choosing to do that rather, you know.
Right.
So they could choose not to do that. And, you know, it's against, you know, the Bible.
Oh, and that's,
so you have that angle to it.
God gave it to them because they're awful, or
and the AIDS stigma that it was like only a gay disease was rampant through the 90s and even into the early 2000s.
I mean, it was really just you know, Rock Hudson, and then there was some model who was a heroin addict, you know, and that's like oh shit, you know, that happens to someone we know, and that happens to a woman, and and then that really kind of what changed it. And then you have, like, all these special episodes of, like, different strokes in the Golden Girls focusing on it.
Very ham-handedly and awfully and embarrassingly. But,
And there's one more thing I wanted to say about that, which was another quote from this. Just because I feel like our generation forgets what it used to be like. You know? Like, we were not alive during this time. And so we came about and sort of grew up through the 90s and the public service announcements and, you know, Magic Johnson and all of that. But this is the reality. So, quote, the public went from ignoring AIDS to panicking over it. A poll conducted by the New York Daily News in 1985 found that 42% of respondents wanted people with AIDS to be quarantined.
I remember those discussions.
News reports featured stories of nurses quitting rather than treating AIDS patients, prison guards demanding special protective suits to deal with infected prisoners, and funeral directors refusing to embalm dead people with AIDS. Like, people were literally thrown in trash cans because no one would deal with them. Nurses wouldn't treat people. I mean, it was, there was nothing, and then there was panic, and it was a very dark time.
I think the moral there is the phenomenon of fake news is not new.
Yeah.
Because certain publications probably published, I think I remember seeing things on TV with anchors getting it wrong or politicians getting it wrong, saying you can get AIDS from handshakes and hugs and kissing.
We don't really know, and so just be careful.
Yeah, just watch that one Eddie Murphy special, and that kind of just sums up what people thought at the time. It's just,
And then the response to that to Eddie Murphy, at least initially, was just kind of muted. Mm-hmm. Like, that seems like it's in poor taste. And it was only a few years later like, hey, Eddie Murphy, that was kind of fucked up, man.
Yeah.
And he had to be like, yeah.
It's a really good comedy special, but he dates it by wearing that like Michael Jackson jumpsuit. That's always going to look ridiculous. And then, you know, that whole segment of his stand-up is Gay just panic, like, what is, you know, you watch it, it's just like, you just cringe at watching that.
Oh, and I remember.
And other than that, it's like, you know, one of his classic stand-ups, that whole block of material is like, oh, geez, what's going on here?
And I remember being 10 years old at summer camp.
Yeah.
And people having that on audio and listening to it, like on their Walkmans, and then, you know.
On their Walkmans.
Yeah, but now you're indoctrinating 10, 11, 12-year-old kids to this shit. Mm-hmm. And Eddie Murphy is America's sweetheart, even when he's, you know, cursing and he's gone blue, whatever you want to call it.
Like, sure.
You know, it's okay. If your parents catch you with an Eddie Murphy tape, they're probably, you know, they might take it, but they're not going to, like, send you away to, you know, Christian camp or anything.
Yeah, but then again, it's like, you know, what you say about, you know, censoring literature or, you know, like, whatever. It's like, you know, like, or people that say, you know, you should cut out passages of, like, say, Shakespeare because it's racist. It's just like, that is just a good capsule of the attitudes of the time, which is a sad capsule of the attitudes of the time, you know?
I'm sort of grateful that it exists so that we can look back on it and say, this is the attitude of the time.
Yeah.
This was completely socially acceptable, culturally acceptable.
Yeah,
this is how
people...
you
listen to his audience, they're rolling with laughter.
Yeah. No,
and it's like same with that Andrew Dice Clay bit where we just like uncovered that, and it's just like, holy shit,
painful.
What? How did he get away with that?
But it's like, no, perfect. It's perfect that we can look back at that and say that was hilarious at that time, and like, let's not take that away. Let's understand that is the time in which people lived, and that is why so many gay men died.
It wasn't
because
seriously.
And we did not care. It was a joke.
Yeah, exactly.
It struck somebody close to you, like, oh my God, my cousin, oh my coworker that I really like, oh my neighbor who's been so nice
to me.
It's
that empathy gap, right?
Yeah.
Unless it affects me, I don't care. And
And it wasn't until really, Rock Hudson, and that was it. It was like, oh, he's a, you know, that movie star that's beloved. And
everybody's mom was like, oh, wait a minute, I grew up loving Rock Hudson.
He's so hot.
But of course, the headlines were, oh shit, Rock Hudson was gay this whole time. And then it was kind of like, well, we love Rock Hudson, so maybe
what
do we
exactly
do with that information? How do we process that?
Yeah,
gay men are awful, but I love him though. But what about him, though?
Oh, it was the same with Anthony Perkins, who my mom was actually friends with.
Really?
The original Psycho.
I love Anthony Perkins.
Yeah. He was closeted gay, and he died of AIDS in the 80s. And his family sort of tried to cover it up, but it kind of was known. They called it cancer. It was really AIDS. And then they're like, oh, Anthony Perkins was gay? Well, we really loved Anthony Perkins.
How can that be?
Well, this is bad.
You
know? So sometimes it takes that. The nameless, faceless, regular people don't perk up anybody's attention. Somebody,
the literal generation of men who died.
Well,
doesn't matter. But like, Rock Hudson. Oh, well, I guess we have to start caring.
Well,
I
mean, Magic Johnson. It was Magic Johnson was a huge deal too.
Yes.
Because
he's an athlete.
Well,
aren't gay men all just queenie running around with limp palms and, you know, glitter?
Limp palms.
You know what I mean? Like limp wrists.
Well, the point about Magic Johnson was we were kind of coming down from the hysteria of it.
Yeah.
And the treatments were starting to get a little better, and you know, there sort of stigma was coming down, and people were sort of maybe relaxing a little bit, and then it's like, oh shit, this can happen to Magic Johnson, who's ostensibly straight.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody loves him, and he was fortunate enough to acquire it at a time when the medicine came to such where he's now, he may live to be 80 or 90,
yeah,
which
sure,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Or at least way he'll live way, way longer than other people that acquired it just a few years before him.
Yes.
Right.
And, but that sort of like, I remember being, I was 15 or 14 and it kind of shook us all up. We're like, whoa, this can happen to Magic Johnson.
Yeah.
Damn.
And he really became the face for it for my generation. Like there was so many like after school specials and stuff with him and like.
Well, you know what he did that was great? He didn't hide away.
No.
He was like, yeah, I'm going to go on living my life. I'm even going to come back and play in the NBA for a little bit.
Yeah, and I'm going to talk about safe sex.
And he also had a late night talk show.
Yeah, it was awful.
That was really bad. Yeah. What was it called? Like the Magic Hour or something like that.
It was. So did Pat Sajak. So I mean, back then.
Yeah, yeah. I just remember Howard Stern always making fun of it.
No, it was really bad.
I don't know anything about that.
But it was great that like, okay, well, Magic is out there and he's speaking and he's still married and he's playing basketball and he's opening businesses and he's. People are around him all the time, and oh, wait, he's a normal person living a normal life. He just has this disease he needs to manage. And I think that took a lot of stigma, maybe even subconsciously, away from it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So we've gone down the AIDS avenue. We've gone down the anti-Muslim gun stores that hate. You know, minorities avenue.
Well, we'll get to after the break. We hope you stick around, Harmon, because I do have a bunch more questions, especially about some of the Gonzo stuff, because we find that a lot of fun. And I just have some questions for you. Of course, we're going to have to get into the thing we heard on This American Life with OJ a little bit and sort of how that might relate to current politics in a way. But
then we have to actually talk about like what's going on.
We'll cram that all into 45 minutes. Sure.
Yeah,
it's not
sure.
a problem.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Hello, and welcome back to Irreverent Testimony. We have the awesome Harmon Leon with us, kind enough to join us. We're ranting about Trump and conservative and the failures of modern culture and blah, blah, blah. All this great uplifting stuff for your Saturday evening, Sunday morning, whenever you might be listening. And Harmon, I know that Rachel, I think, had a couple burning questions, or at least one or two she wanted to get off her chest.
Yeah, so... one of the articles that you wrote was about presidential joke writers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is something that is near and dear. I'm kind of a comedy nerd. And I feel like people don't know that these presidents aren't just super funny. Like somebody writes these jokes for them, you know. But President Obama, can we just acknowledge that he's the fucking funniest? Like, just the cadence and the way that man was able to
timing.
Yeah. The timing and the like,
Great timing. Great timing. He could sell a joke. Again, so I interviewed, within that story, Bill Clinton's head joke writer for his entire sort of term.
Yeah.
But, what he said was like, Obama has great timing, but he always looked like he was someone reading a great joke and sharing and like reading a great joke at the same time as us. So, but he could sell the joke, you know? So it was like, and then I interviewed like George Bush's joke writer and he would actually confirm that George Bush was one of the most natural comedians. I mean, on so many levels, but like, we're just talking about like selling a joke, you know, he would come across really natural.
I can see that. Yeah. I could see him being sort of the life of the party, getting a few pops in him, and, you know.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think, like, looking at the White House Correspondents' Dinners, I love Obama. I think, especially, like,
he
had the
self-effacing, you know, just being able to make fun of himself, which, you know, our current president.
That's exactly what I wanted to get to, is, like, he has, I really believe he doesn't understand comedy. I don't think that he has a sense of humor because he's a narcissist. He doesn't I really don't think that he thinks anything is funny. Like, I don't.
Well, I'll just paraphrase through Bill Clinton's, you know, joke writer, is that his comedy is like always like punching down instead of punching up. You know, it's always like putting himself in the superior spot and you know, aiming his humor to people that are below him. You know, it's just comes across as being a bully rather than being a humorist. And so that's not really comedy when you're, you know, you're punching down with your humor.
Right. I mean, yeah, exactly. Like, Obama having on Luther, his anger translator, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, maybe like one of my favorite things that's ever happened in the history of anything.
Was that Jordan Peele?
Even more than Obama dropping the mic. I mean, that was excellent.
I know, but no.
That was so many great, you know, just Obama funny moments.
Yes, no, but I really like,
death panels. Like, he would just make fun of what the critics would say about him.
Exactly. And that,
like, it so endeared us to him, you know?
And then Trump's like, I'm not going. I'm just not going.
He's just a fucking asshole. He won't even throw out the opening pitch for the opening of, like, the baseball season. He won't. No, I'm booked up that day.
Well, he knows he'll get booed.
First, he can't throw a baseball, but just like, why would you? That is such, you know, that's American tradition. Well, I mean, you're putting yourself in, like, you know, America first. And you won't even throw out the opening day baseball?
Well, there was a great article in Deadspin.
Insanity.
In Deadspin, imagining a scenario where he, like, trips over and falls backwards and, you know, shows his gut to the country and starts sobbing or something. It was great.
Yeah.
But you had mentioned, I don't know if Rachel mentioned it, that you had covered a roast of Donald Trump, and it was just the most awkward, awful thing that you could possibly imagine. Was that something you saw or that you attended?
No. They actually, that was through just interviewing these joke writers, these presidential joke writers, that they told me about it. But that was a Comedy Central special. They roasted Donald Trump a few years ago. And actually, some couple of friends of mine were like writers on that. That I knew from like the San Francisco comedy scene. But I think, I forgot who wrote, like, there's someone else who wrote, like, a really great article of what it was like to write for Donald Trump. He would just, like, kill jokes.
Oh, God.
Like, would just not understand the whole premise, I think, of just, like, you know, what constitutes a joke.
Right, that's sort of what, that's sort of, beyond all of his horrificness, there is this, like, thing that he doesn't get. Jokes. He doesn't understand humor, I think, fundamentally. I don't think that he gets why things are funny, because he's a narcissist.
Yeah,
that, like, I really.
Yeah, that whole charity dinner when it was like, that was just weird. Suddenly, like, you know, it was like the two days after the debates, and then suddenly, like, he's shoulder to shoulder with Hillary, and, you know, they're making wisecracks at each other.
Yeah.
First of all, that was just plain, like, if you want to be like Illuminati conspiracy crazy, you know, just to seeing that goes, oh, wait. And then, but just, you know, he had, that was like the worst, anyone's like, my
ever.
Friend, he was like a George Bush writer, just said, he's never, you know, that was the worst anyone's like bomb, like during those type of things, which is for charity.
Right.
And he just made it self-serving of, you know.
Yeah. Punching down, like you said. Yeah. It's
crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy. Okay. The other thing is, you wrote a story back in 2013 about marijuana, and we live in Colorado, so we talk about this.
Yeah, there
lot.
You go. Sure.
And the focus of your story was sort of about how to unschedule marijuana from a Schedule I to something else so that we could understand that it has medical benefits and sort of the roadblocks that you encountered. And, I mean, I think that's fascinating. The story itself, how you called all these different agencies and everyone was like, talk to someone else. We don't know. And there's no way to do it. And we aren't in charge and yeah. all of that. How do you feel about having gone into that sort of space and now all these states legalizing sure. it? And like, how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, it's just to be like a Schedule I drug, first of all, you know, up with like the most dangerous drugs, you know, how ludicrous, you know, in modern era, how ludicrous is that, you know?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, when I was talking to the federal agencies, they didn't want to make a confirmed statement because they knew, you know, it could change like, you know, in a week or so. So,
yeah, even the Obama administration wasn't ready to go full on and fully embrace marijuana, which was weird.
Yeah, at the beginning of the Obama administration, he, you know, according to this, I forgot what the, was it Normal or whatever the guy yeah. I talked to just said, like, Obama's administration was like, probably like the worst as far as like, you know, marijuana rights were going like early on. But then, you know, things sort of changed in his last couple of years.
Well, now, but, you know, we're worried it's going to get weird with Jeff Sessions, who's like a reefer madness guy. Like
he really he's obsessed. Right. He's obsessed with mm-hmm. marijuana. He seriously must have had like some college roommate that fucked with him or something because he is obsessed with like marijuana is very, very bad and it's the worst thing. And I'm going to do everything I can. And as the
I don't care what the state rules are. Yeah.
Right.
It's the most important thing. The most important thing for the attorney general is like marijuana.
Get that joint out of your
mouth. Well, yeah. When it's like, you know, you just look across the board of you know, how many states it's legalized in, and you're suddenly going to pull back that mentality. It's.
Well, try it here. Let me tell you. That's tantamount to taking our guns away, taking our weed away.
That's a thing for Colorado. Exactly. Like, we talked about how we're sort of a fiercely independent state.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Sessions coming after pot in Colorado is going to be really bad.
Well, that just won't happen. I mean, you know, again, and you can even look at it from a well, Colorado would just put facts of like just putting like economic facts down, you know, of like, you know, how much money is actually making, you know, for the state's economy, you know, billions. And you're going to mm-hmm. actually try to take away, you know, just from that angle alone.
And the way that we structured it tax-wise, it benefits mm-hmm. schools in our state.
Sure.
And so what you're saying is you're going to not only come with your state's rights bullshit on the back burner and come mm-hmm. do something that our state has agreed that we want to do, but also you're going to then take funding from our kids' schools. I just...
Where we have big school funding problems to begin with.
Yes.
Sure.
Number 49 in the country for school funding and shit. Like our economy our economy is a complicated mess.
There's weird tax laws. We won't get into it. It's arcane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think he's going to try. I mean, he's already said, like, this is a priority. We're going to enforce federal law. And I just don't know.
It's down the list, though, right? He's got to cover his ass on Russia. He's got to take away voting rights for all brown or semi-brown people.
Yep.
You know, he's got to do all that shit. So maybe marijuana's a little further down the list. But I think it's a pet project for him.
He loves to talk about how bad pot is. And neither of us are pot smokers. Like, we just don't.
A lot of friends are, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. Most people I know. Yeah, but
I mean, just even look at it just from the medical standpoint. You know?
And that's something that our state is considering doing mm-hmm. ahead of thinking that the federal government may crack down is... there's a coalition in our state government that's going to maybe try to say that anyone who currently sells recreational pot can reschedule themselves as medical, which would take a giant chunk out of our tax base because we tax medical marijuana at a much lower rate than we tax recreational. And so
right.
murder that. But that's something that's being proposed right now is everyone gets to reclassify as medical just so that we don't take away those jobs and those industries here. I think it's a terrible idea. I think we should just fight back, but that's something that's being proposed.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't see that really pushing through in 2017, but then again, everything is so off the charts. You never know. I think it'll be proposed,
so like,
but
who knows?
Yeah, but it's just like, you know, again, the good that comes out of the evil is just like people, you know, have been taking action. We have, you know, things are proposed. So that's, you know, the takeaway of like, yeah, we got this crazy guy, but it actually makes people, you know, do something.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
So I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of your undercover infiltration kind of things that you've been doing over the course of your career. You are probably the ballsiest motherfucker I've ever seen in comedy that does this kind of stuff. I mean, like, Tom Green sort of does stuff like this, but it's just, like, goofy, like, showing up at a girl's soccer game and being an idiot. Like,
you... That was a funny bit.
Oh, no, no, it's funny, but it's...
Yeah, yeah, no, I know, I know. Basic. I was just thinking back. I forgot about that bit. Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm. Or, like, showing up with the old man tennis club and, you know. But, so... I'm thinking back specifically to the Applebee's story, and you noted in the book how, like, you really didn't know what was going to happen. You were nervous. Were they going to jump you in the parking lot, or, you know, carry you off in a van? And so was that one of your first forays into doing that kind of thing, or had you already been doing that for many years?
Yeah, yeah, no. The first foray was the first story I did of that sort of genre was I got a job at a fast food restaurant with the sole intent of being hired and fired within 3 hours. So, yeah, working under a set of ground rules that I devised.
How did that work out? Just
They wouldn't fire me. It was like the graveyard shift at Jack in the Box. So again, you know, trying to make a statement about the work. You know, minimum wage workforce.
Sure, of course.
Or just the apathy of it.
So how far did you go? What did you do to try to get fired?
Oh, just like change out of my uniform, go back to work in my regular clothes, and do that like twice. Yeah, just, you know, just like refuse to do things.
Oh, that reminds me now of another story when you did the Uncle Sam thing for the tax preparers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was a lot of fun and showed up the other guys because, like, when they came around the corner, you were just going crazy with it and jumping up and down like an asshole. But my next question was, have you ever found yourself in a scenario where, whether it's, like, the Oath Keepers or Minutemen, like, where you were actually like, oh, shit, I'm really in too deep. I may have fucked up, or I'm actually genuinely scared something bad's going to happen.
Yeah, it's more like the stories that you wouldn't think would get you in trouble in the only one where I was just like surrounded by a group of people screaming at me because they knew exactly what I was doing was when I infiltrated a celebrity impersonators convention as like a fourth rate Austin Powers impersonator. And they just like were just screaming at me.
That like, sounds like a South Park angry episode.
I know, like I had this angry Cher and this like just screaming at me, like all these like it's like, oh, this is what it'd be like if these actual celebrities were mad at me.
Like imagine like pissing off Cher and Michael Caine and Rivers RuPaul at the same time.
Yeah, I know. So it was like, yeah. So again, it's like again with like Applebee's and all these Oath Keeper ones, it's just like more like. They're just so happy to have
somebody who's interested. Yeah.
It's like, oh, there's another one of us. You know, there's so many people against us. We're happy to have a new guy.
Yeah.
You know?
I could see that.
And it's always about your approach of just being like, I was just my approach is like, I'm just wide eyed, sort of like impressionable and enthusiastic.
Yeah.
And they're just always happy to have me on board most of the time.
Well, that brings me to Fred Phelps. How the fuck did you get there? How did you convince them to let you into their little awful?
Oh, I just emailed them and politely asked. So again, that was like more like just me going there as a journalist rather than infiltrating them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, they're kind of media whores, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
They kind of like if you're holding, you know, the signs that they hold that are in neon colors and waving them around in public. You kind of like attention, don't you?
Right.
Yeah. And any publication that wants to come in and listen to you talk, I could see that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was insane. They just like, I was like eating dinner at their house. Like, Shirley Phelps would buy me salmon.
Yeah.
It's like they let me just have full access into the full realm of their crazy.
And it is.
Now, they're scary on several levels, but mm-hmm. I think the biggest level is they are so devout in the belief of what they're doing that
it, yeah, it's a cult.
Yeah, it's a cult. Yeah. And if they decided one day, let's poison the whole neighborhood, like, mm-hmm. they'd just fucking do it.
Yeah, well, they're devout in a way that is, like, they're true believers. This is not, like, I'm just going to beat you with the Bible because it's convenient for me. This is a true belief that they're right. Yeah?
Yeah. And here's the scariest part of them is, like, they are, you know, it's mostly one family. And they're a family comprised where almost everyone is, like, the adults are lawyers or work for the Kansas Department of Corrections.
Wow.
So you got that going on. So, rehabilitating prisoners to come back into society or their lawyers, but their lawyers mostly on First Amendment sort of cases.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, I have a First Amendment issue. Why not get the crazy people with the signs to represent me?
Wow.
Yeah, so that part alone is like that they're not just, you know, they have it very well thought out, which is scarier.
Since his death, I think it's sort of been falling apart, which I think is expected, I guess, for me at least. Mm-hmm. His granddaughter, Megan Phelps, got out. And now she's, like, doing TED Talks about how awful it was and, like, sort of...
That was the weirdest part because, like, their kids on one level, I could just have, like, normal conversations with them. And it's like, what the fuck are you doing? You're, like, you seem normal. And, you know, and then thankfully for those are the ones that, you know, just left, you know. They don't... I mean, that's like, you know, again, you're in a cult. So, like, from day one, if that's all you know... That's all you know, so it's like, you know, of course, you know, that's like, you know, child abuse. So,
yes.
But and thankfully, yeah, I mean, I'm so, you know, happy to hear that they're the people that I thought were like normal and they were nice. And yeah, they got out of the cult, you know, so it's like, yeah.
Well, we have a suggestion for your next infiltration.
Sure.
Of course, you don't have to, you know. give it any credence whatsoever, unless you've already done this, which you may have.
Sure.
You're familiar with men's rights activists, right?
Yes. I've researched them before. So yeah, if you have a, what would be your angle? I mean, other than just the like them, but yeah, I mean, of course.
Finding out what makes them tick. Well, let me give you an example, right?
Yeah.
They had a thing planned here, but mm-hmm. they were going to meet, but it was so like disjointed and so, like, out in the open, and, like, they really didn't know what they were doing. So I think they were almost, like, they were out on, like, Craigslist, or where were they advertising?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
they at first they were going to meet, like, in the science museum. Then they were going to meet at the bike racks.
The entrance of the science museum, and it was, like, all public, and there was going to be all these protests, and then they were like, never mind, we're not doing this. I forget what
But then you get the protesters showing up.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. They call themselves something Kings. Kings.
The new kings or the kings
something
of
kings,
oh god yeah like yeah the closest I've the done to that and, yeah I did the Promise Keepers. I think that started in Colorado, which is just this Christians men's group, all just men. We're just men, no women allowed,
and you we're know, gonna
bunch
talk
of
about
macho
like,
men talk about Jesus.
Yeah, and it's all about like,
well, this is more like, we have a right to, there's no such thing as rape, and we have a right to have sex with all the women we want because we're men and something. Right? Mm-hmm. Is that, mm-hmm. is that about the
I mean, of it? I don't know. I dig into some of these MRAs, and I just, it's so terrifying and depressing for me as a woman that, like, I just can't.
Well, they felt very empowered because of Trump.
I can't get into, like, the...
Yeah. So suddenly, you know, much like the white supremacists, they're just like, all right, our guy's in.
Yeah,
suddenly we're not in the shadows. We're in the forefront.
We can grab pussies and say the N-word out loud, and it's
America great again. Yeah, because our leader does it.
Well, what's been amazing to me is the very sheepish nature by which Trump and his people sort of don't really push back and don't disavow, and they sort of either don't bother to do it, or they do it very weakly, and
no, they have it all like Bannon is just an evil villain in a Batman movie,
yeah.
And he's just very divisive of like, say it's like Holocaust Remembrance Day. They know their fan base, and they know they don't want to alienate their fan base.
But they essentially get away with it.
It's not like a mistake. It's all really well thought
out.
No,
I realize that. But my point is the pushback is just very...
Sure.
I think, again, this is the case of the media and people sort of not knowing what to do with this. Like, well, wait a minute. The administration sort of isn't...
Against white supremacy?
Like, that's fucked up. Oh, well, I don't even know what to do with this.
How do we normalize this?
Right.
How do we make this seem like a normal news story? And I'm like, fucking stop.
Yeah.
Fucking stop doing that. Stop trying to make it normal.
And it's not.
No, yeah. When you normalize the unacceptable, then the unacceptable becomes normal.
Exactly.
It's like, yeah.
And so, even NPR, who we listen to get our news from, is actually kind of the mm-hmm. worst offenders because they're very much by the code. Like, well, if the president says it, we kind of have to... say the pros and cons, and
you said NPR or
yeah, NPR.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. Right.
It's like ironically, they get sort of caught in the trap of, well, we cannot mm-hmm. appear biased, and
sure.
But it's so frustrating because it's not biased to say that the president is like kind of a Nazi. It's just a fact. His chief uh-huh. of staff is a fucking Nazi.
Well, yeah, Stephen Miller and Bannon.
Yeah, like, I mean, like these people are not hiding. They're not like. Trying to pretend that they're anything but what they are, and I think that the traditional news media just goes like, I don't know what to do with that. I can't call the chief of staff of the president of the United States a Nazi, and I'm like, yes, you can. You can't uh-huh. because that's what he is. So you have to. And they're like, no,
right.
We can't do that. That sounds like we have taken a side and we don't take sides. And I'm like, no, that's just reporting the facts.
No, the best uh-huh. thing to do is call his views controversial.
Yes. The controversial... Yeah, yeah, yeah. Chief of staff. No, the Nazi who's running the White House is what you can say because that's the truth. And he wouldn't say that that's not true. He would be like, yeah, pretty much.
Or he'd just be like, well, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I want to talk about, before we get done with this, I want to talk about Mike Pence for a minute.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I gave him a heads up.
So this little story comes out that Mike Pence, cannot and is not allowed to or chooses not to or something eat food with members of the opposite sex because he's married. Also, he calls his wife mother, which is deeply disturbing to me.
Yeah, it's like
yeah, that's
Buffalo
weird.
Bill Silence of the Lambs Ooh. Thing. Yeah.
But, yeah.
And so this is like...
And at what point did he start that?
Oh, God, right?
That's, like, fucking weird.
When they got into the diaper
fetish, it's like, whoa.
Mother. Sorry, mother. Yes, mother. I mean, it's fucking yeah. weird. It's fucking weird. And the media, or the internet, rather, mm-hmm. has sort of taken this and really run with it. Like, Twitter, in particular, has just made a mockery of this entire notion that, like, of course you should not eat food with people that... are women. That would be very bad. And it's very good. Isn't he a loyal husband? Isn't it great that he doesn't eat with women? And like, lol, and there's been lots of funny shit that's come out of it, and I've enjoyed it tremendously. But I do want to say that I think there's something darker that we have to talk about, which is the misogynistic worldview that takes, that encapsulates that. You know, yes,
oh, yeah.
It's funny he calls his wife mother and he can't eat food with women, but like,
yeah.
It's actually a much darker thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means is maybe if he's just like a dude who works in real estate in California or whatever, fine, he doesn't eat with women, but he's the vice president of the United States. And considering how Trump's administration is going, he may soon be the president of the United States.
Yeah.
And it's twofold for me. Number one is women for Mike Pence don't get a seat at the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
Literal table. But like how can he hire women? How can he talk to women? How can he, if he views women as this temptress, this thing that like he can't be around, right? Then
right.
What we're saying is that women do not have a place in this administration. Women do not have a place next to power. Women do not have a place, for Mike Pence anywhere other than, I guess, his wife or in the kitchen or something. The second thing is that I think it reinforces rape culture. I think that Mike Pence saying, I can't be in the same room as a woman eating food, mm-hmm. is saying, I have no control over my own sexual agency. And so I'm putting the responsibility of my sexual agency onto women and saying, you just can't be around me. I can't control mm-hmm. myself. Sure. So yeah. it's your job to just not be around me.
Yeah, yeah. It's just an alcoholic mentality, you yeah. know, just like a white knuckle alcoholic, just, you know, just saying I can't be around booze.
Right. Except booze is women. And
I can't be around pussy.
Yeah.
I can't be around literally anyone that has a vagina because I don't know what I'll do.
Just look at him as one way.
And we're all just one giant temptress, and he wouldn't be able to control himself. So just don't be there. Just don't be present. Yeah. Just be away from me because it's your job to help me control myself.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's not literally saying that, but that if you infer it, if you take his position to its logical conclusion,
yeah,
this is where we're going.
This is where we're going. And we were talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, you have the whole executive order to defund Planned Parenthood, where it's just a group of men kind of all looking really pleased with themselves.
Yes. All smug and very happy with themselves. He looked goddamn delighted when he was.
Well, we forget about Pence, don't we? I mean, it's just he's so overshadowed by the headliner act. We forget that he's the one who has it together with the evil agenda.
That's right.
Waiting in the wings. And
that's right.
Yeah.
He wants to electrocute me.
Again, what do you want? Do you want the evil we know or just the off the rails clown?
Well, that's what we've been talking about. We would take the evil we know because we know how to fight it.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, if it's like Ted Cruz is like, you know, you don't want the really smart guy who's just really divisive. We just have, you know, the clown act who just is making it up as he goes along.
But I think at least the Republic would stand under Mike Pence. I'm not sure that that's true under Donald Trump. But I mean, Mike Pence, we have to remember, like, he would never have won a Republican primary. He could never mm-hmm. be elected president. He is so fucking conservative. He literally wants to, like, electrocute me because I like women and take away. He would rip the IUD out of my body if he could. He hates me. He fucking hates me.
And he's a conversion therapy guy.
Yes, he is. Yeah. Very much so. Very much so. Conversion therapy and...
Which I've infiltrated before.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Oh, it's just... again, it's just a boatload of crazy summed up, you know, that the best relationship you'll ever have is with Jesus Christ. It's just like your options are... They're basically, to paraphrase the website of the group I infiltrated, is of how you cure people of homosexuality is step one, marry a woman.
What if you are a woman?
There you go. Yeah, exactly. So, we just did a video on conversion therapy, and one of like the things was like just taking a tennis racket and hitting it against a pillow and screaming. That's just like,
it's horrifying. And it does serious psychological damage to queer people.
No doubt. Yeah, of course it does. It just like creates depression and suicide.
Yeah.
It's just, because you just like have to be ashamed and hate yourself.
It also, I think, is the reason that there is any argument that being gay is a choice, because I think that so many people that say that have chosen to be straight or chosen to be
to pretend to be straight,
have chosen to live a life where they are constantly pushing down who they are. And so for them, being gay is a choice because they've made a choice to try not to be. And that doesn't mean they aren't. That just means that they see it as a choice because they can choose to live a horrible, miserable, fake life. And so mm-hmm. why can't everyone else be as miserable as I am?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. And Was that the one, Harmon, where you were, your go-to line was always, "What will we tell the children?" And that always worked no matter what.
That was like, so there was a three ploy to that infiltration. That was like, first we went to this parent support group. For parents that have
gay kids.
You know, their children are for gay, they have gay children or they're worried about them. So I just recruited like this actress friend of mine, and we went, and you know, we're concerned about it, like our 7-year-old Tobias, and, like what you know, and it's just like these these parents were distraught, you know, and it's like the worst thing that could happen to them. It's horrible,
right? It's like, yeah, it's like a support group for like parents with kids have like terminal cancer, as far as
yeah. So it's, you know, and their cure is just simply, you know, it's just like more Jesus would cure this. Wow. You know, simple answer for them. Simple, you know, answer to it all.
So with the last 10 minutes or so, we want to pivot a little bit and talk about your experience in reality TV with O.J. Simpson.
So you were on This American Life.
Right, right.
Which is like my favorite thing ever. And I didn't know that this was you, that you did the segment about Juiced, I guess.
Yeah. Now, the O.J. Simpson hidden camera prank project.
Yeah.
Comeback vehicle.
Punked meets candid camera meets...
Yeah, meets O.J. Simpson.
Meets an acid trip. Like, I remember hearing about the show. Like, like there was word of mouth. Like, there's a new, like, punk show with O.J. Simpson. And I remember thinking, that sounds like the most miserable experience that...
Yeah. And again, going back to what we're talking about, Trump and humor, is like, the producers of Juice just forgot the whole comedy theorem that hidden camera pranks aren't funny if pulled off by a guy who the majority of America sees as a murderer.
Yeah, and they tried to compensate by just having everything be utter, senseless, mindless chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, it kind of made me think like, well, that's a decent allegory for the White House in some ways.
And O.J. Simpson pulling hidden camera pranks?
Yeah.
That's where we are, I guess.
We're all being punked on a national level. But like, I thought your insights just into like you observing him and the way he acts and was really kind of fascinating. Because here's a guy who... he's so sick and like really, now he's a sick guy, obviously.
Yeah.
and he's never addressed that. He's never really gotten help for it. And he's just sort of allowed to, and then finally he got busted for doing something really stupid in Vegas and he's finally in prison for something that pales in comparison to his worst crimes.
But it just showed a pattern of just being a sociopath, you know?
Yeah, sociopath, yeah, totally. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't – you wouldn't see it. It's not really unrelated. It just fit with his pattern of, you know, just
– I think more of a
behavior.
I think more of a psychopath. It's hard to tell because they – you know, in the piece they played that phone call where he seemed to be ready to take his own life. And but then you have to wonder, like, was that all a ploy? Was this for attention? Like, what was he really up to? Was he actually feeling remorseful in that moment? Like, what is going on?
I think he was like, oh, shit, I can't be lovable OJ anymore.
It's very upsetting.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, shit, you know, I'm not going to be the beloved guy, you know.
Why can't they just forget about all that murder
stuff? On the TV commercials.
Why can't they just forget about all that murder stuff and love me like they used to?
Yeah. So it's just like within like day one of like filming that. So I was there like filming that for like 2 weeks. It's just like first you're just like you get enamored like, oh, you know, because he's like, you know, at one of the most famous people in the world because of that murder trial. I'll call it that murder trial, the murder trial. You know, that murder trial thing. So you get caught up in like, you know, the cult of celebrity. Wow. Hey, you know, OJ's being friendly to me. And then like but that just like dismisses within hours. And you go, okay, he did do it.
Yeah, definitely. For sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, just you just watch him, you know, of just how he deals. Like, just this fake charm he puts on everyone, you know?
Yeah.
And just, but just, you know, you just, you could just see that was just like a facade.
God.
So, kind of, what was your biggest takeaway from that experience in the realm of sort of this idea of, I don't know exactly want to call it reality TV. It was more like an attempt of like a wild and wacky candid camera, like,
kind of
thing.
What kind of asshole decided this was a good idea?
I'll tell you exactly what kind of asshole. It's the producer who brought the world bum fights and backyard wrestling.
Oh.
So it's like, again, if you want to talk about levels of psychotic sociopaths, is it OJ for doing this, or is it the guy who's the puppeteer getting – OJ to do this?
Yeah,
thinking it's like, this is gonna be cool, everyone's gonna talk about it because he murdered people and he's pulling pranks.
Yeah,
you know, it so it's like, who's gonna be sharing a table in hell together?
Well, it doesn't surprise me that OJ agreed to do it for exactly the reason that you just said, like, can't everyone just love me again? But
yeah,
it does
surprise
me that anyone else thought this was a good idea. Anyone on earth funded this or thought this was an appropriate thing to do.
Well, it's very 90s, I think. Like, there was a time in the 90s where anything sort of hidden camera reality was kind of selling or had a chance to sell. And then there was also this, like, thing, like, we're going to be as wacky and crazy as possible. And
no, it's coming off the heels of Jackass. So it's all right, how do we out Jackass? We'll get O.J. Simpson to do this shit.
Right, and the striking thing, the way you describe it, was that, like, the people who were the marks were just kind of like, whatever. Oh, that's O.J., yeah. But, you know, they're, like, nonplussed by the vase smashing and random vomiting and naked women, and it's just like they didn't lose their shit like they were hoping, or they didn't freak out, they didn't get mad for the most part.
Yeah, all the gags were constructed just around this simplistic premise of something happens and then OJ Simpson pops out. It was pretty much the construction of every single gag, and then, you know, we'll all show some naked women in between the gags.
And
so I think they kind of just, like, broke it down to that low-hanging common denominator formula.
Right. Which for the 90s was kind of typical. Like, we also watched a little bit of your infiltrating that blind date show where they show the little – cartoon thoughts of the people. While they're driving, and so we weren't. The quality was so bad on the YouTube video. We weren't sure what was going on, but, like, did you actually infiltrate the show, or were you doing sort of a parody, or was that the actual show?
Oh no, I infiltrated the show.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
It was really hard to, like, couldn't read the captions. The quality was so bad.
Oh, yeah.
But I just remember thinking, like, this is the worst thing on television, because I think I had a girlfriend who really loved the show at the time.
Oh,
so we had to watch it all the time.
Yikes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like that show is just comprised of just people who want to break into acting, you know?
Sure, yeah.
That's what the woman just said, like, her agent told her to try to get on the show to get exposure.
Oh,
so you got
God.
A lot of that going on. So, yeah.
Wow.
It's kind of like this or porn. Okay.
Yeah.
But the one thing from the OJ takeaway that I found interesting was eventually it was no fun for him anymore. So he would just kind of show up drunk, and you had to carry the whole thing and say the lines. And
yeah. So, like, after a while, like, they couldn't get OJ pulling pranks. So I think they just went for the option of getting OJ near some pranks while they're being pulled.
Well, in a way, that was kind of more fun, though, right? Because you could run the show, although the script was horrible and it was...
No, it was just all... It just got grim and depressing. It was
I could see that.
It was just, just OJ drunk, or he wouldn't show up. And just leaving, like, the whole crew standing there. I mean, again, it's just like, all right, that I see that. It's like he's, just a social path, on this shitty hidden camera thing. He's just, like, not showing up.
So you took this gig, the way you describe it, and this is kind of knowing your personality, you took it almost not in a sense of like, oh, this is a big chance to be on a big hit show. Like, I think you kind of took this gig thinking like, this is sort of a bizarre, macabre social experiment, and man, I would love to be in the middle of that.
No, I took the gig because like, I'm gonna write the best story ever
from being this. Yeah,
yeah, that was the whole thing. It's like, yeah, dude, I was just taking notes the whole time, and it's like, I get to witness this right on the front lines.
Yeah, like being in the middle of it.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
As a journalist, sort of, rather than as like, oh, I'm so excited to do this horrible project.
So is there anything as bizarre and misguided since then that you feel like you've been a part of or in the middle of?
Constantly, you know, well, just from, you know, the stories in Trump era America. I mean, it's just kind of like nonstop. I mean, that was just reality TV.
I see you're starting to do what like Chris Arnaud does, where you go into these, you know, the white America, suburban conservative, trying to get in their heads. And of course, these people since the election have been sort of romanticized.
Yes.
As mm-hmm. like, what makes white conservative Americans tick in the suburbs?
Mm-hmm. How do we get them back? What do we need to do to cater to these white people?
We've forgotten mm-hmm. about them.
Makes me fucking crazy.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I know what you're doing is not going to sort of paint that romanticized light, because I think there is a lot of like liberal coastal guilt that like, oh, we've ignored these people and now it's bitten us. And
fuck
we need
these
to...
people is what I say. Fuck them. Let them go. I don't want them. I'm mm-hmm. not going to cater to a bunch of racist white assholes. And I'm not going to do it. I won't. I will lose forever before I cater to these people.
Okay. Well, in the few minutes we have left, Harmon, like, what are your early takeaways from doing that kind of journalism in that sense, from getting in with these people?
Oh, I always just find it fascinating, be it is like crazed Trump supporters or the Phelps family or O.J. Simpson, of really getting inside their heads and seeing how their minds work, mm-hmm. how they process information and see the world, you know, and kind of like really filling out that picture.
And so from like going into these communities or talking to these people, the ardent rural or exurban white Trump people, like what are some interesting or different takeaways, or maybe things you weren't expecting or were expecting? Like,
well, again, it's like, you know, you can put a broad generalization, but everyone has their own individual story.
Right.
So it's really kind of about again, it's just like getting their individual story. Why are they thinking like this? How are they processing what, you know, it's sort of like just being in these scenarios that are the complete opposite of yourselves and seeing it in their shoes and not, you know, a large majority of the time you disagree with 90% of what they say, but sort of like trying to see maybe the 10% of how they see it, you know. It's just really just kind of just getting the full picture.
And is there any common denominator you're finding with these people other than like sort of for fear of brown people and fear of something? Because it's definitely fear-based.
Yeah, a lot of it is fear-based, and a lot of it is, you know, the opposite end of Bernie of like, all right, here's a guy talking to us where we're –
we haven't felt
the other people are calling us deplorables and here's a guy who's really is giving us attention. So, you know, there was a large part of that, you know, mixed with all the xenophobia and all that. So it's just like, you know, it's just kind of like they're frightened people who are losing their coal mining jobs. And here's a guy saying, I'm going to bring back your coal mining jobs, which is not going to happen. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's our industry started in the 1800s involving being under the ground, under the earth.
This is the problem I think, my liberal friends, and we didn't even get time to get into the Jill Stein Bernie bro people, mm-hmm. but like getting into these people's heads and finding like a common denominator and saying, well, we feel ignored. And so mm-hmm. we can say, okay, well, we understand that. Here's some attention. Here's our platform. It includes rights for brown people and immigrants and LGBT people.
Sure.
That's where we're never going to – it's just never going to
– yeah.
they're never going to join our
have
tents.
A progressive platform, as long as we want to be inclusive and it doesn't just be about white people, they're mm-hmm. never going to come over, even if you pay them all kinds of attention and promise to bring back their coal mining jobs.
And
which
I think
is
that's
not true.
What Bernie doesn't understand.
Yes.
Or he does understand, mm-hmm. but he's going to
well,
he's
he going to
ride that
them.
Line. Right, right.
He doesn't talk about.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for President Al Franken. That's all I want.
Amazing. I love Al Franken. So
he's the only one that's really getting in their faces.
Yeah. And Elizabeth Warren, I would give her.
Yeah, that ticket would be
Warren Franken.
Warren Franken.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're starting it right now.
Very sharp people.
Harman has announced it, the Warren Franken ticket for 2020.
Oh, well, I don't think I'm like the first to come to this conclusion, but that.
Well, you're
yeah,
the first on
I
mean, our show that has, and that's
yeah,
all that
yeah,
matters.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah.
Well, we're about out of time. So, Harman, please plug everything you got for our listeners so they can check it out.
You can check me out on Twitter at Harman Leon, my website, harmanleon.com. We have a podcast called This is the President. Where we rant about politics and then dissect presidential phone calls. You can find that on iTunes. All that. And if you're in New York, I run a regular live storytelling show called Tale. So you can check all that out. So
how often do you record how often do you record your podcast?
We try once a week.
Cool. That's about the same as us. Anyway, yeah. There's a book that's about 12 years old now called Republican Like Me by Harman, and it's not dated at all. In fact, it's frighteningly current in
it
many
is.
Ways.
It is, yes.
So
I've been reading
it's
it.
Available
it's
on Amazon and everywhere else. Go get that. Any other of your books you want to plug? Because I know you've written a bunch
there's
of amazing
like
books.
Yeah, there's like six of them, so you can check them out. And actually working on a new book at the current moment, collaborating with my friend Ted Rall, who's a political cartoonist.
Cool. Nice.
Can't
okay.
wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank cool. you so much, Harman.
Yeah,
we could
for
talk
being with us.
All
we
friggin'
just...
day. An open
yeah,
invitation. Anytime you want to come and rant or whatever or talk about weed politics or anytime you have an open invite if you ever want to join us again. Thanks for taking time out of your Saturday, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was good talking to you guys.
Okay, so check out Harman's stuff. Check out his podcast.
We'll post links in the show notes.
Yes, we will. And if you want to talk to us at Irreverent Duo, reverenttestimony@gmail.com. We've talked about our special guests from out of town who we will have on at some point. And don't go too far. Stay active, stay tuned, stay involved. Adios.
Bye.